Okay, Exodus chapter 19. And actually, if you look at chapters 19 through 31, they're showing us God's covenant, and the which is the Constitution. It's interesting to me. And just humor me and please let me use the word Constitution. I like that word. Okay, we have the Constitution of the United States, right? Which governs is the governing factor of the United States. Well, the governing laws of the nation of Israel was given by God. Why can't we call that Constitution? I believe we can, can't we? And so in these chapters, you see the Constitution of the nation of Israel and the plan and the order for worshiping God. Now, in chapter 19, we'll read some verses here, but I want to show you something. You may already know this, but God offers the priesthood to the entire nation of Israel. But they don't want to accept the priesthood. It's interesting, isn't it? If you look at verse 1, it says, in the third month after the children of Israel had gone out of the land of Egypt on the same day, they came to the wilderness of Sinai. Now, the wilderness or desert of Sinai is at the base of the mountain of Mount Sinai. Okay, so when we talk about Sinai, you climb the mountain, all right? And we'll look at the map as we go along, refer to a couple things here this evening. It says, for they had departed from Rephidim, had come to the wilderness of Sinai, and camped in the wilderness. So Israel camped there before the mountain. Now, if my math's correct, this is 2 months after they made their exodus from Egypt. They made their exodus from Egypt on the 14th day of the first month. And it says this is the same day, if I interpret this correctly, which would be the 14th day of the third month. And the Israeli calendar was laid out in 30-day periods. So this would be exactly 2 months from the time they made their exodus until the time they came to Mount Sinai. Yes, and then they would add a 13th month ever so often to make up for the days lost. We'll get into that later on. Okay, I think we'll get into that into this study, either in Leviticus or Numbers 1. We'll look at that. Verse 3 says, Moses went up to God, and the Lord called to him from the mountain, saying, thus you shall say to the house of Jacob, tell the children of Israel, you have seen what I did to the Egyptians and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now, I want you to note something here. They're camped in the desert or the wilderness of Sinai. God is on the mount of Sinai, mountain, and he calls Moses to come up there so he can talk to Moses on the mountain. He's not coming down where the people are. He calls Moses up to where he is, all right? Verse 5 says, now therefore, if you will, you can just circle that, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you shall be a special treasure to me above all people, for all the earth is mine. Now, does that sound like a contingency? If you will, then you shall. What if you will not? Well, the underlying statement of that, if you will not, you shall not, right? And he goes on to say, and you shall be to me a kingdom, a priest, and a holy nation. These are the words you shall speak to the children of Israel. Now, this is what God's telling Moses to go down and tell the nation of Israel. He says, you know, if you'll obey my voice, if you'll follow my ways, you keep my covenant, all these things. He said, then I'm going to make you a special treasure to me, and you will be a kingdom. Now, we already know from past study, well, I shouldn't say that. Let's just start right here. The word kingdom, when you look at it from the Greek perspective, is the word basileia, and it's dealing with a rule or a realm. Talking about royalty. And what God's saying here is I will make you a realm or a kingdom priest. Now, you think about this. When you think of kingdom, you think it's ruling, don't you? It's Some of us do, right? No, when you think of kingdom, you think of ruling. And know what God says, I'm going to make you a kingdom of priests. Now, he's speaking, he said tell the entire nation. He didn't say tell the tribe of Levi, did he? Well, now keep that in mind. Verse 7 says, so Moses came and called for the elders of the people and laid before them all these words which the Lord commanded him. Do you see delegated authority here? Moses called the elders together, and now it'll be their responsibility, right? All right? It says, then all the people answered together and said, all that the Lord has spoken, we will do. So Moses brought back the words of the people to the Lord. Now, do you see why they call him a mediator? He was a mediator between the nation of Israel and God. God calls him up and says, Moses, I want you to tell this to the people of Israel. Moses goes down, he says, people of Israel, this is what God says. They says, all right, they say, all right, we'll do what God says. Moses goes back up, he said, God, they said they'll do what you said. Interesting, isn't it? But that's the role that he's playing. Verse 9, and the Lord said to Moses, behold, I come to you in the thick cloud, that the people may hear when I speak with you and believe you forever. So Moses told the words of the people to the Lord. Then the Lord said to Moses, go to the people and consecrate them today and tomorrow and let them wash their clothes. Now I believe there's some things in all this. If you want to get into God's presence, be clean. Now obviously they're doing it naturally. But I believe that's conveying a spiritual truth to us, you understand. And he goes on to say, and consecrate them today and tomorrow, let them wash their clothes, and let them be ready for the third day. For the third day, the Lord will come down upon Mount Sinai, not in the wilderness, but on the mount, in the sight of all the people. In other words, God's going to come down, and the people are going to see it. Okay? It says, you shall set bounds for the people all around, saying, take heed to yourselves, that you do not go up to the mountain or touch its base. Whoever touches the mountain shall surely be put to death. Now that's a serious thing, isn't it? Now we talk about holy ground. Boy, when God designates it and sets the parameters around it, that's holy ground and you better not cross that boundary line. And it says if anybody does, then what happens? They're killed. 13, not a hand shall touch him, but he shall surely be stoned or shot with an arrow, whether man or beast, he shall not live. When the trumpet sounds long, they shall come near the mountain. God says, I want them to come near, but I don't want them to get too close. Isn't that interesting? I want them to come near, but I don't want them to get too close. Wonder why? Well, if you check their track record up to this time, they've been a rebellious, murmuring, complaining, grumbling people, haven't they? They can't afford to get in the presence of God. That may tell us something, I don't know. Verse 14, so Moses went down from the mountain to the people and sanctified the people. They washed their clothes, and he said to the people, be ready for the third day. Do not come near your wives. Now, I looked at that today, and I thought, you know, that's interesting, because to me, the message he's conveying is I want you to get your attention off of the flesh. Get your attention on preparing to get into the presence of God. I believe that's the message that's being conveyed here. Verse 16 says, then it came to pass on the third day in the morning that there were thunderings and lightnings and a thick cloud on the mountain, and the sound of the trumpet was very loud, so that all the people who were in the camp trembled. I wonder who was blowing the trumpet. And Moses brought the people out of the camp to meet with God, and they stood at the foot of the mountain. Now Mount Sinai was completely in smoke because the Lord descended upon it in fire. So they're not seeing the face of God, you understand. Its smoke ascended like the smoke of a furnace, and the whole mountain quaked greatly. Now, if you turn over to Hebrews, the 12th chapter, you see the writer of Hebrews making a contrast between Mount Sinai and Mount Zion. And he said, we're not talking about you and I today, the believer today. We haven't come to Mount Sinai, where if even the beast crossed this line and touched the mountain, he had to be killed. But where have we come? We've come to this holy Mount of Zion. We're at a better place where He tells us to come boldly to the throne of grace, not to stay away from Him, but to come near to Me. Different mountain. And it said Moses, the writer of Hebrews said Moses was so scared at this time that even he trembled. There must have been an awesome sight, you understand, to see the whole mountain just covered with smoke and fire and the earthquake and the trembling. I've got a feeling that'd get your attention. It sure got theirs. Verse 19 says, when the blast of the trumpet sounded long and became louder and louder, Moses spoke and God answered him by voice. That's audible. Not by dream, not by vision, not by speaking to the inner man. God answered him by voice. Then the Lord came down upon Mount Sinai on the top of the mountain, and the Lord called Moses to the top of the mountain, and Moses went up. Then the Lord said to Moses, go down and warn the people lest they break through to gaze at the Lord, many of them perish. Isn't that an interesting statement? He knows that He's already told Moses to set boundaries. Moses has set boundaries, now God's telling him to go down and do it again. He said, also let the priests who come near the Lord consecrate themselves, lest the Lord break out against them. But Moses said to the Lord, the people cannot come up to Mount Sinai. In other words, hey, look, I've already told them, the boundaries have already been set. They can't come up. He said, for you warned us, saying, set bounds around the mountain and consecrate it. Then the Lord said to him, away, get down, and then come up, you and Aaron with you. In other words, God knew that they needed the second warning, didn't He? He said, no, you get down and tell them again. Well, sometimes we need a second warning, don't we? But do not let the priest and the people break through to come up to the Lord, lest He break out against them. So Moses went down to the people and spoke to them. Now, when we go into chapter 20 of Exodus, we're getting the Ten Commandments. And who are these commandments given to? The nation of Israel. Is this correct? I mean, these commandments, this is the Constitution God's giving for the nation of Israel, or at least the foundation of the Constitution. There are other laws that we'll find that are given also. And God spoke all these words, saying, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. You shall have no other gods before Me. Now, you know, really when you think about it, that's an interesting statement. What other God would you want if one just brought you out of bondage and parted the waters and made bitter water sweet and provided you with food, why would you want to serve another God? Isn't it interesting that He has to tell them that? And isn't it interesting that Israel's constantly going after other gods? I don't know that it's a lot different today, you know. He says, you shall not make for yourself a carved image, any likeness of anything that's in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them, nor serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children to the third and fourth generation of those who hate Me, but showing mercy to thousands to those who love Me and keep My commandments. Now, I don't know if you've ever traveled in other countries, third world countries and all this, and it's hard for us to relate to gods as far as carved images unless we see it in the book or something like that. It's just not an everyday encounter that you and I have. But it is just commonplace when you go into these other places. Now, I've been told that India has 150,000 gods. I heard somebody say the other day they had 3 million. Now, I don't know where he got that. But I've seen more carved images than you can shake a stick at. And you look at those things, I've stood there and looked at that, and I think to myself, who in the world would want that ugly looking thing for a god? I'm going to tell you something. You don't know how blessed you are to have the revelation that God Almighty is the Creator of heaven and earth, that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. We're spoiled people. I mean, we don't even realize how fortunate we are. And then I stand there and look at that, and then something happens on the inside, and rather being critical, I just said, God, if I would have been born here, I'd have probably been bringing stuff to this statue myself.
coconuts, bananas, or whatever. But for the grace of God. Now he's telling his people, don't make idols. Well, in America, instead of carving them out of wood, we make them out of flesh. You know, athletes, superstars, songs, you know, whether they're a singer, country singer, rock singer, or whatever. We make our own gods, don't we? Better watch that. I'll start meddling. I don't want to go that direction. All right. Verse 7 says, "You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain." Now, for years, all the time I was growing up in church, they were telling me that means you don't cuss. That's not talking about cussing. Now, I'm not advocating cussing. I mean, let's get that clear. But the people that would tell me not to use the four-letter words and all that, they're the very people when something happened, they say, "My God." That's taking the name of the Lord in vain. And I believe some of the worst people in the world do that, preachers. We need to be cautious how we use the name of Jesus in the name of God. It's not a byword. If we're calling out on God, we need to be calling out on God. Not just some byword. You understand? In other words, what's vain mean? It means it has no value to it. It's worthless. It's futile, right? Well, why would I use the name of God when it's not profiting? That's what he's saying here. Not that we're under the law, but we should be exceeding the law. You see that? He said God won't hold him guiltless. Then remember the Sabbath day or the day of rest, keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work. But the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord your God, in it you shall do no work. You nor your son nor your daughter nor your male servant nor your female servant nor your cattle nor your stranger who is within your gates. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea and all that is in them, and rested the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath and hallowed it. Kenny's going to get on to me because he thought he had that popping out of here and I'm not helping it. Honor your father and mother that your days may be long upon the land which the Lord your God is giving you. You shall not murder, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not steal, you shall not bear false witness against your neighbor, you shall not covet your neighbor's house, you shall not covet your neighbor's wife, nor his male servant, nor his female servant, nor his ox, nor his donkey, nor anything that is your neighbor's. Now that's what we call the Ten Commandments. Those are the things that were placed in the Ark of the Covenant. For every generation, those things were in there. God's covenant, God's constitution to the nation, what they were supposed to do, how they were supposed to live. Talking about the nation of Israel. Actually, if you look at the Constitution of the United States, at the very principle, it got its roots from the Ten Commandments. Of course, now we don't need them anymore, you understand. We're so wise and educated now, we're smarter than God, so we just kick Him out of everything. And open Congress with a Muslim prayer. That sickness gone to seed, isn't it? Verse 18 says, "Now all the people witnessed the thunderings, the lightning flashes, the sound of the trumpet, the mountain smoking, and when the people saw it, they trembled and stood afar off." God said, "Tell them to come near." We're as close as we want to be. A little too close, right? It says they stood afar off. Verse 19, "Then they said to Moses, 'You speak with us, and we will hear, but let not God speak with us, lest we die.'" Isn't that interesting? This thing scared them so bad, they said, "Look, Moses, we don't want God talking to us anymore. Give us a mediator. You go talk to God like you've been doing. You know how you did in Egypt and all that? You go talk to God, and then you come back and tell us what God says, and we'll believe you." Because this is scaring us too bad. Now see, God gives them the opportunity to hear Him speak, and they don't want it. I'm telling you that today, God gives every believer the opportunity to hear Him speak by His Spirit. You don't need the mediator of a pastor. Now, I'm not saying you don't need a pastor.
I'm not saying you don't need a teacher. I'm not saying you don't need the fivefold ministry. I'm saying that if you have a need, you don't have to camp out on your pastor's doorstep. You have as much access to God as he does, if you're a born-again believer. You see that? As pastors, we aren't mediators. You understand? We're messengers. And there is a difference, isn't there? Verse 20, Moses said to the people, "Do not fear, for God has come to test you, and that His fear may be before you, so that you may not sin." So the people stood afar off, but Moses drew near the thick darkness where God was. Now you explain this to me. How could the mountain be covered with smoke and thick darkness and fire at the same time? Isn't that what he said? God came down how? As fire. Isn't that what it says? Now this will give you a little insight in why the people later on thought Moses was dead. This scared them so bad to see the sight, they couldn't imagine anyone going into that and coming out alive. You see that? And now he's entering into darkness. And I suspect that Moses was just a wee bit concerned himself. What do you think? Now when he goes up there, it says, "The Lord said to Moses, say to the children of Israel, you have seen that I have talked with you from heaven. He said, you shall not make anything to be with me, gods of silver, gods of gold, you shall not make for yourselves." Now, where is this? Where's the location that we're talking about right now? Mount Sinai? How soon we forget. They're right there at Sinai. God has spoken to them. He's already told them in advance. This is not the time that He writes it on the table of stone, if I'm interpreting this correctly. He's speaking to the whole nation. Remember? He's speaking to the whole nation. And now He's reiterating here, and He's telling Moses, He said, now, you tell them that you don't want them, don't make anything out of silver and gold and call that a god. I am God alone. I don't need help, is the essence of it. You don't need a statue to remind you that I'm God. So don't make one. He said, an altar of earth you shall make for me. And you shall sacrifice on it your burnt offerings, your peace offering, your sheep, your oxen. In every place I record my name, I will come to you and I will bless you. Now there's a powerful message right there. I'm going to tell you where God's going to come and where God's going to bless is where His name is. Every place, every church building that has the name church on it doesn't have God's name on it. You understand? So you're not going to get blessed in every church or under every ministry. God's coming to the place that He's appointed, where He's ordained, to where His name is resting. That's where you're going to find the blessing of God. And it's important that we realize that and not run here and there everywhere. And it's interesting to me, He's not looking for an elaborate altar. He's not looking for an elaborate way to worship. Isn't it interesting how we think we've got to be so elaborate and so proper in the way we go to God? Some prayers just about make me sick. Because I think of what Jesus, in talking in the Gospels, you remember the Pharisee and the publican that went to the temple to pray? And this really sticks out to me. It says the Pharisee prayed to himself. The publican cried out to God, "Be merciful to me." Now the Pharisee, I'm sure if you were standing there, his prayer probably sounded pretty good, you know. Oh, that's a beautiful prayer. Well, did it get any higher than your head? You understand? Was it to anybody other than you? You know, I think a lot of times we pray not so God hears us, so the people hears us. And then that what we pray for, God answered. The people heard us, and that's it. God's just looking for the simple things. Make an altar. You want to worship me? then do it out of the earth. Do it out of what I made, not out of what you made. Different, isn't it? You understand when he said make this thing out of stone, you couldn't carve that stone into the shape you wanted. You just pick up a stone and you place those stones on there. Why is it that we've got to fit things into a particular mold? Or think we have to. We don't, but we just think we do. And I believe these are some of the things he's trying to point out to us through this old covenant. And there's some common sense in all this. He said, if you make me an altar of stone, you shall not build it of hewn stone. For if you use a tool on it, you profaned it. God doesn't want us messing with it. You understand? Don't carve it into what you want it to be. Make it what He wants it to be. Now, I believe that applies to a lot of things. I believe it applies to our personal life. Don't worship God your way. Worship God His way. And I believe it applies to the corporate side of it as well. Don't try to do it the ways of man. Do it the ways of God. But how do we want to build our churches? We want to go to a church growth seminar and get some guru to tell us how to grow our church. Well, it's not ours in the first place. No, if you're going to worship God, do it God's way. Don't build it your way. Use what He has given. Don't try to fabricate something. Okay? Verse 26 says, nor shall you go up by steps to my altar, that your nakedness may be exposed on it. Now, I believe that's about as plain as a nose on your face. You know, the men wore the... They wouldn't appreciate this. I call them skirts. They do this in India. You know, they still wear the... I don't know what they call them. I call them skirts. And I promise you, you climb up steps, you look up a man's skirt, you understand? And that's what God's saying here. I don't want you doing that. I don't want you exposing yourself. In other words, use a little wisdom. Well, I mean, we do the same thing today, can't we? Thank God we're not wearing skirts, man. Now, that might be a little hard for me to adapt to. But I think some women could appreciate that, couldn't they? Now, when you get into verse 21, now he starts giving details concerning the constitution of the nation. And I want you to know that this is how the nation of Israel ran. This is the government that ran the nation of Israel. This is the Supreme Court laws, if you will. And these things were what they followed when they passed judgment, and I promise you they did do that. Now, I'm not going to go through and read all these, but I do want to bring some things out some of it I think is humorous. Not in its setting, but in our setting, okay? It says, now these are the judgments which the Lord shall set before them. If you buy a Hebrew servant, did you get a Hebrew? What's that? One of your own nationality. If you buy a Hebrew servant, he shall serve 6 years, and in the seventh year, in the seventh, he shall go out free and pay nothing. If he comes in by himself, he shall go out by himself. In other words, he goes out with what he came in with. If he comes in married, then his wife shall go out with him. If his master has given him a wife, and she has borne him sons or daughters, the wife and her children shall be her master's, and he shall go out by himself. Isn't that something? That's why you have to get the full counsel in here. You have to get all the laws in here. That's the property of the master, if he gave it. It says, but if the servant plainly says, I love my master, my wife, and my children, I will not go out free, then his master shall bring him to the judges. In other words, they're going to witness this. He shall also bring him to the door or to the doorpost, and his master shall pierce his ear. Oh, we thought we came up with that here recently, didn't we? No, the Bible, this is right here in the Bible. Back then, they pierced their ear. But now look at why they're piercing their ear. That'll give you a revelation. It says, pierce his ear with an awl, and he shall serve him forever. Let me tell you what the pierced ear reminded everybody of then. Slavery. Interesting, isn't it? Because when you put your ear to the doorpost and he stuck the awl through it and pierced your ear, put the ring in it, then what you're saying is, I am His servant forever. I refuse to be free. Then he goes on and talks about man selling his daughter to be a slave and how there's certain laws that go for that. And then if a guy buys one and is a betrothal for, and all this, that he has to deal with her according to the customs of daughters. He can't deal with her deceitfully. If he brings her in and you know, to take for a wife or a son don't like her, then he can't sell her. He's already disgraced her. She goes out free, a free woman. Then he says if he takes another wife, and I'm sure a certain denomination could appreciate this, he shall not diminish her food or clothing and her marriage rights. And if he does not do these three for her, then she shall go out free without paying money. And I see a principle here, that it's the responsibility of the husband to provide food and clothing for his wife and her marriage rights. Now, if you don't know what marriage rights is, I hope we're adults. In other words, I believe that this is talking about sexual relations and her having children and this type of thing, okay? He owes that to her. Now, you see this over in the 7th chapter, 1 Corinthians. Paul saying, look, the woman's body's not hers, it's her husband. He said, look, the man's body's not his, it's his wife. Each one has their rights. Now, if I understand correctly, that's what he's talking about, her marital rights, the food, the clothing. And if he refuses to do that, then the woman goes out free. I don't know if I should delve into this or not, but because any time I mention this, people read me wrong. I get accused of something that I'm not saying. But please humor me, okay? I believe that if a man is intelligent, he would only want one wife. Okay? For many, many reasons. Okay? But to say that, to use the Bible to prove your point, you can't do it. Now, I have a reason for saying this. Now, we're in a Western culture, so this is not something that you and I encounter very often, if ever, unless we live in some areas of Utah or whatever, you know, which they've even actually banned now. But if you go into places like Africa and all this, that's an acceptable practice. The one area we were in, the village chief had 7 wives. Now what happens, you know, the missionary goes over and gets this man born again, and then they tell him to get rid of 6 of them. No. No, sir. No, sir. It's not scripture. He has an obligation. You see that? Now I'm not teaching, and we got this on tape, I am not teaching polygamy. Okay? I'm just telling you that you can't take the Bible and go into a culture like that and tell the man that he's sinning. If it had been a sin, I'm sure God would have written it in the law. And isn't it interesting that Israel came from how many women? How many women? 4. How many husbands? 1. You get the point I'm making? It's interesting how we'll take our little pet things and try to make a doctrine out of this to prove our points. And I'm just telling you, don't do that. Okay? And then maybe you'll never have this situation to deal with. I have had. I've had somebody to come to me and ask me counsel. What should we do as the church in this situation where a man has more than one wife? I said, don't put him in leadership position. That's what the Scriptures teach. You can't make him a bishop. You can't make him a deacon. He can sure be a church member. Get the full counsel. See where I'm coming from? That's what I want to say about that. That's all I'm going to say about that, okay? And except for this, I do not advocate polygamy. Okay? But anyway, you see all this, all right? Now he says, if a man strikes a man and he dies, what happens to him? Kill him. Isn't it interesting that God believed in capital punishment and we don't? You understand, God gave these laws. Moses didn't come up with this. God's telling Moses these things. He said, if a man kills a man, kill the man. I had someone, I got called to jury duty, I don't know, a couple years ago, and they asked me what my occupation was. I said, well, I'm a minister. They said, do you pastor a church? I said, yeah. They said, do you believe in capital punishment? I said, yes, sir, I do. For some reason, they didn't need me, and I didn't argue. God did. God does. Why shouldn't I? He says if it's accidental, that's one thing. But if he tries to kill him, that's another thing. You understand? We're talking about premeditation now, and he said you kill him. If a man kidnaps a man and sells him, he said if you find him in his hand, what do you do with him? Put him to death. Kill him. Kidnapping's capital punishment. Isn't it interesting that that's how we based our laws in the United States to begin with? And how we've gotten away from that now through our liberality, how we've moved away from these things. Now you understand laws are for the lawless, not for the church, not for the believer. But I promise you a nation has to have laws for the lawless. The church has to have order for the lawless. Right? So we can follow these examples. He says, who curses his father or his mother shall surely be put to death. Well, now, we'd wipe out millions today if we did that, wouldn't we? Now, he goes on and tells us that if two men get in a fight and one of them injures another one, and he doesn't kill him, but he does permanent injury, that you don't put him to death for it, but he has to pay for his loss of time till he's thoroughly healed. Well, now we do that in courts today. If you have a good enough lawyer, you know, you can get... This is following the... You see the principle, where it came from. I'll put it that way. And then he talks about a man beating his male or female servant with a rod. So that he dies, he should surely be punished. Do you know that they can do that in other countries? And it's legal. Now, I'm not advocating going buying a slave. You understand? I'm not saying that. I'm just telling you that I've traveled enough that whatever you build your foundation on as a doctrine, make sure it'll work in any country in the world. Let me tell you something. If your doctrine can't be preached in any nation on earth, it's not sound doctrine. God's not a Westerner. So we can't just make everything Western. See what I'm saying? Now, when you're in your culture, you live by your culture. When you're in their culture, you adapt to that culture. You know, in their culture, they come up and hug my neck, I'm not going to do anything. You know, I mean, you know, greeting one another with a holy kiss, right? But now, I just, in the Western culture, in this United States, being in the South, men don't kiss men. You know what I'm saying? Not real, man. There's wisdom in all that, right? Moving right along. Now, he's talking about if two people get in a fight and one harms the other, then he goes into to verse 20, and I want you to look how we pulled this out of context. If a man beats his male or female servant with a rod so that he dies under his hands, he should surely be punished. Now, notice that it said punished. Even you understand that's his property, but yet he's going to be punished. Notwithstanding, if he remains alive a day or two, he shall not be punished. For he is his property. If men fight and hurt a woman with a child so that she gives birth prematurely, yet no harm follows, he shall surely be punished accordingly as the woman's husband imposes on him, and he shall pay as the judges determine. But if any harm follows, then you shall give life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, strike for strike. Now note the context that's written in.
And if a man strikes the eye of his male or female servant and destroys it, he shall let him go free for the sake of his eye. If he knocks out the tooth of his male or female servant, he shall let him go free for the sake of his tooth. Now, you know, some people, I guess, would be foolish enough to take this and teach it as a doctrine that it's all right to whip your servant, knock his teeth out, and blind him. That's not the message that's being conveyed. In other words, God's saying there's a consequence to abuse. That's the message. If an ox gores a man or a woman, what happens to the ox? The ox gores a man or woman and they die. He said, kill the ox. It says if that ox had a tendency to gore in previous times and the owner knew it and he hasn't kept the ox up or confined and it kills a man or a woman, he said, don't just kill the ox, kill the owner too. Now, you know what God's saying? He's saying there has to be accountability. Now, I just saw something on the news not too long ago, within the last year, where this person had these vicious dogs and had them. His whole reason for having them was because they were vicious. He knew they were vicious. They had attacked before. One of his dogs attacked and killed, and they wanted to have him up for murder, and people were pitching a fit about it. No, that's scriptural, people. In other words, somebody has to be accountable. And it's time that we start holding we start holding ourselves accountable as well as our nation, as our church, our home, or whatever. We have to have accountability. Oh, we're no lone rangers. And when we try to be the lone ranger, then we get ourselves in trouble. If you're the top and the buck stops with you, make yourself accountable to somebody for your own sake. Now, he goes on and tells all these things dealing with the ox and how you dig a pit and some ox falls in it and it dies and you're responsible for it and all these things. And then when you go into chapter 22, here again we're dealing with civil laws. He's talking about if a thief breaks in and he's caught breaking in and the man strikes him and kills him, he said, there's no consequence, there's no guilt. But now you have to keep reading. It says, but if the sun has risen, in other words, if he does it in the night, that's one thing. But if it's during the daytime, there is a consequence. He said, there shall be guilt for his bloodshed. He should make full restitution. If he has nothing, then he shall be sold for his theft. In other words, the man breaking in is going to be accountable. He's not going to get by with it. This day and age, you can get by with it. You know, you can have a criminal record as far as from here to that door and be out on the streets walking free to keep on committing your crimes. No, there has to be some consequence, and I'm going to tell you what. The consequence is this. The punishment must be much more severe than the crime. You want to stop the crime, make the punishment more severe than the crime. You know, in some of the eastern countries, first offense theft is cutting off the right hand. You know, you're not going to steal but twice. You'll have to become innovative after that, right? And I tell you what, you don't see many one-armed men walking around, you know. I mean, they realize the consequence. Let's stop and take a break. Oh, my.